And thanks to Vaso Vasovich for his Serbian music and talking. Hello, this is thegooddrugsguy.com on Resonance 104.4 FM and ResonanceFM.com. This is a show that answers all your questions about drugs, legal, illegal, prescription and placebo. Every week, we're on our hands and knees, combing through the carpet of drug culture, trying to find that last nugget of truth because we know we dropped it down here somewhere. At the same time, we'll be pulling out the best stories, weirdest news, most crazed characters, and forward-thinking lab jockeys. I'm Piers Gibbon, and my mother wishes I had a real job. You know so much about plants and cacti, and you have an Oxford degree. Surely you could be a gardener?
I'm David McCandless, and I haven't actually told my parents that I'm doing this show, so please don't tell them. And don't tell them I write for the broadsheets about drugs and drugs culture either. They still think I review video games for a living.
I believe that every single thing that is known about a drug, good and bad, should be available to everyone who's considering using that drug.
On tonight's show, really excited, we've got an interview with Dr. Alexander Shulgin, biochemist, godfather of ecstasy, creator of over 200 new psychedelic drugs. We kiss his indole ring.
Only about 12 people in the world will get that joke, so don't worry if you didn't.
Stay tuned to find out exactly what we mean. Plus druggy tunes, a bit of advice, and more. But first, the news. Have you ever tried peyote or even ever heard of it? Well, it's a cactus that grows in Central and North America that contains the powerful psychedelic drug mescaline. It's regarded as a sacrament by the Huichole people of Mexico, and it's still used to this day by the Native American church in their ceremonies all across the United States. Uh-oh, because mescaline is, of course, a Class A, Schedule 1, prime cut, ninja-level big bad drug, which has caused no end of headaches for the American government, caught between their constitutional laws on freedom of religious expression and its urge to obliterate all drug use and crush all drug users! So, in the US, peyote is legal for the 300,000 members of the Native American church, but it's very much illegal for everyone else. Why? Well, because it's bad for you, of course. The American government would have got away with this assertion if it wasn't for those pesky scientists and their insistence on reason-based evidence. This week, they released a new study into the long-term effects of peyote.
A bunch of researchers tested a group of Navajos, some who ate peyote regularly and some who didn't. And bingo. Psychologically, the peyote users were in much better shape emotionally than those who didn't use the drug. Why? Well, mescaline doesn't harm your brain, first of all, say the scientists, but also the church members take it in a supportive context and are very careful with it. They don't go to their best friend's wedding or travel on the Circle Line in rush hour while tripping. That appears to be the secret.
It also tastes really bad, and that probably keeps you from taking too much as well. Native American church members say it's like tasting yourself.
So have you had mescaline?
Peyote, yes, I have. I think actually on a sort of eco-friendly level, nobody should eat peyote at the moment. It gets overpicked, and people who don't know what they're doing pick it. Much like magic mushrooms, people just sort of wrench it out of the ground, which means it doesn't grow back next year. So take care. And if you were to go down that route, it would be San Pedro you'd be looking for.
And what's the experience like?
Very powerful. It's a methylated amphetamino. I just ran out of knowledge.
What does that mean? Methylated amphetamino. 2CL.
I don't know what I'm talking about. But I do know that it has an up effect as well as a trippy effect. So it's hallucinogenic and it's a stimulant.
Oh, so it's like two drugs in one.
Two drugs in one. Christ. Are we allowed to broadcast that?
Yay! Yeah.
Now here's a story that is really depressing and tragic on oh so many levels. In Dublin last weekend, a Halloween partygoer who had taken magic mushrooms leapt to his death, convinced he could fly. According to The Sun's Irish edition, his girlfriend watched in horror as he plunged 40 foot from the balcony of a plush apartment. The mushrooms were bought from a local herbal shop because magic mushrooms are still legal in Ireland. Senior police officers now plan to hold emergency talks with justice ministers to discuss changing the law. It's one of those stories that keeps coming back, this, isn't it? The jumping out the window. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, at this point, you know, we're tempted to play the Bill Hicks quote about, you know, if you think you can fly, try starting off from the ground. He had lots of very unfriendly things to say about people jumping out of windows.
I always thought the psychedelics and flying thing is a bit of a myth, you know, like the one about staring at the sun and burning your eyes out. But actually, recently I read about Richard Alpert, or Ram Dass, as he's known, who was a very early LSD pioneer. Him and his gang took lots and lots of LSD under various conditions, and actually he did jump out of a window to see if he could fly, and he ended up breaking his arm. But this was after he'd taken LSD for 3 weeks, every day for 3 weeks.
Every day for 3 weeks, which you couldn't do with magic mushrooms, because, oh, well, I suppose you keep doubling the dose.
Yeah,
but anyway,
you'd be taking a whole forest by the end. You know, this guy is a doctor and he's a very solid thinker, and yet he still believed he could fly under the influence of psychedelics. So there does appear to be some element of truth in this.
But hallucinogens do affect you so strongly that you can get into a state where you can think that you can fly. It's a difficult one for us to talk about this, because it's just so depressing that it's happened.
Yeah, this is something we really need to look at, and we all hope to return to this in a future show.
Where do new mind-altering drugs come from? Who invents these things, and why? Well, most seem to have been invented by one man, Dr. Alexander Shulgin. He's an American biochemist who's dedicated his life to the invention of stimulants, depressants, aphrodisiacs, empathogens, entactogens, uppers and downers. Over 50 years, he's created over 200 new psychedelic compounds, including several you may be taking this weekend, and many so rare you'll never encounter them in your entire life. Most are outlawed in the UK, but the majority remain legal in the US. Shulgin's most famous for rediscovering the recipe for a long-forgotten chemical called MDMA. He found a new way of synthesizing it, which made it more available to the outside world. It soon became known as ecstasy, and you know the rest. Today, he and his wife and research partner Anne Shulgin are in their 80s. They live in semi-retirement in California. They grow plants, write books, speak at international conferences, and still occasionally cook up the odd bizarre new drug. We got them to talk to us about their chemical love story. How come you're not in prison?
Well, the direct answer to that is I have not committed a crime, exactly.
We don't touch anything that is scheduled, as they say.
And actually, there has been a general move toward making some of my discoveries into a scheduled status, both there in England and in this country. And as soon as they become illegal, I just leave them alone entirely. That's other people's problems. My is invention, not in criminality.
So how did this all begin? How did you get into chemicals?
You know, the interest in psychoactive chemicals stemmed, some 40 or 50 years ago, an experience with mescaline, which really caught my fancy, that so small an amount of material, 200-300 milligrams, could catalyze such an immense change in the visual and the interpretive function of the mind. I got very intrigued with that, and we went up in the hills behind Berkeley, and I just thoroughly enjoyed what I saw. The colors were new to me, and what was even more impressive is that it rekindled many memories of childhood when I was very small that I had forgotten about. That was more or less the thing that started me on the whole area of psychoactive drugs.
And Anne, what was your experience?
My first experience, my first major experience, was with peyote cactus, which it contains mescaline, which was given to me by a young medical student. It happened also part of Sasha's, my husband's, research group, although at the time we didn't know each other, and Sasha and I didn't meet for another 15 years.
Yeah, that was very interesting that we both had the same chemical at about the same time some 15 years before we ever met.
And it was the most extraordinary day of my life. It's not an exaggeration to say that, and I learned a tremendous lot of things from that. Mescaline is quite extraordinary experience, and it's the peyote is considered the divine cactus for a good reason.
I should say, the mescaline experience was not the effect of the drug. It was the effect of what the drug catalyzed releasing within me. And I said, if a few milligrams of something can cause this type of a transformation, what about adding a molecular group here and maybe an atom over there, maybe changing this to that, manipulating the molecule a little bit, making derivatives and analogs and substitution patterns, and see if one could find catalysts that would release other things or release things in a different way or perhaps with more effectiveness. So I just made all kinds of new compounds and very cautiously proved their structure and tasted them and found out what they did.
Yeah, tell us about this. I read about your nibbling approach to new chemicals.
The nibbling approach is when you have a new compound, you can't find out anything about the mental process changes it might induce by using animal experiments. You really have to take it yourself and find out what it does and what is the consequence of exposure to it. Judging whatever it does without giving a name to the process, just giving a number to the amount of effectiveness, was a minus for no action, a plus minus for something that might be a threshold action, a plus that was a real effect but didn't interfere with your normal behavior, two pluses for something that will affect that did interfere with your behavior, and three pluses being something you wouldn't drive on. So in essence, we rank them on the potency, on the basis of pluses, but this in no way embodies the nature of the action. That's an independent thing.
But Sasha always starts with a new compound at the very smallest possible amount.
And then often a tenth of that.
Yeah, right. And goes up very, very slowly over maybe weeks to get to the stage where he begins to feel effects. And in this way, he minimizes the danger of suddenly running into a convulsant effect or something like that. But the way the research is done is that Sasha takes his own compound up to the point where it's what we call a plus two. And at that point, I usually join him. And we both explore up to plus three, which is the maximum that anyone would presumably want to take. And by that time, we know all the aspects of the effect, whether it it enhances sensuality or whether it represses emotion or whether it clarifies thinking, whatever it is.
And also over the years, not much now, but in the earlier years, we had a small research group of maybe six or eight people who were all curious in the same area. And then once Ann and I had found out a reasonable dosage that was safe and and we knew the duration, then we would meet as a group and find out what it added in the way of social interaction and what the variation from person to person might be.
And so what have been some of the highlights? What have been some of your favorite discoveries?
Well, some of the rather favorite have been, what is 2CB, which I found to be a very, very relatively short-lived and a very comfortable, friendly material. 2CE, I think Anne would classify this area as a material that is much more demanding and yet very much of a friend.
Well, other people have called it the teacher, though.
Oh, yes.
You don't go to 2CE, which is very hard to make, by the way, so we haven't sampled it for more years than I care to think. You don't go to it for euphoria. You go to it for pretty tough lessons in the spiritual sense. It is a teacher.
An interesting material, not a favorite by any means, but interesting in that it affects the senses in a different way, was DIPT, diisopropyltryptamine, which rather than causing visual changes, causes auditory changes. And indeed, with it, the sound processes you hear are changed in pitch and changed in proportion, in that harmonic distortion is induced. I'm quite intrigued by it because it obviously goes to a portion of the brain that is auditory rather than visual. And I find that that is a potential tool for diagnosing cases where people hear voices rather than see visions.
Have you created sort of negative psychedelics?
Oh, yeah.
I can think of two or three in which there is not only a fair amount of nausea, but also in which there can be nightmarish dreams in trying to recover from their effects. They are interesting. I'm thinking of something like alpha-O-dimethyl serotonin, in which even at 2 or 3 milligrams, you have a very difficult experience, often body rejection, and nightmare dreams that are very uncomfortable. And that's more often seen than not.
And also there are some drugs that have been developed which you don't feel emotion about anything. There's a total lack of emotion, and we just don't take them twice. That's the end, because neither of us wants to be divorced from a very important aspect of ourselves, and we certainly wouldn't dream of making them available to anyone else.
Presumably you both had many psychedelic experiences. Could you put a number on the number of drugs and the number of experiences you've had in this particular area?
And how would you say as far as...
Well if you realize that some materials are taken more than once, I believe I've taken more than 2,000.
And I probably impressed that.
Yeah, right. And we still are alive and functioning pretty well.
Yeah, you seem to be, although you could be high right now, for all I know. Aren't you worried about becoming addicted?
With two exceptions I can think of, psychedelics are not in any way addictive. They simply do not pull people into continual use. That's not what happens in this world. But with one exception especially, I would say ketamine, which a lot of people use, which is a very valid anesthetic. Ketamine can be very dangerous.
We know two instances in which people have been involved with it and have gotten so deeply involved that as they cut out their use and try to overcome the dependency, they are still quietly using it all the time, just still using it. A very, very sudden addiction with ketamine.
And the very sad part of it is that some of the people we've known who got caught by this are extremely intelligent people who have written and published books, etc. But what seems to happen is even when they stop using it, if they have had a very, very frequent use before, even when they stop, there seems to be thinking disorders that remain. And so I suspect that there's permanent brain damage.
So, a note of caution there for any ketamine users. We're just going to take a little music break. We'll be back with the Shulgin shortly. Listening to thegooddrugsguide.com on Resonance 104.4 FM. We're back talking to Alexander and Anne Shulgin. Over the last 30 years, Dr. Shulgin has synthesized over 200 new psychedelic drugs and tested them on himself and his wife. and by all accounts, had a very good time doing so.
Psychedelics do have a reputation and a following of a spiritual nature and a mystical nature. Where do you stand on these issues, and how do you feel that psychedelics can help you in that realm?
First for you, Ernie.
Well, the spirituality is really, it's an aspect of this that I am not that familiar with. I look at it primarily as tools. So my search is not looking for personal spiritual improvement, but for materials that can be used clinically. And that's the reason I published directly into the clinical scientific literature. And on the spirituality, maybe you should address this.
Well, to me, the psychedelics I can't say all of them. Some of them are definitely exceptions. But the psychedelics open doors to one's own psyche and a great deal of the unconscious material that we all contain inside ourselves becomes available. And to me, the psychedelics, like visionary plants, one form or another, these tools have been around probably since mankind was in the caves. I mean, there's evidence from thousands and thousands of years ago, there's evidence of visionary plants being buried with certain bodies. So I feel that they are immensely important, but they have to be used with very great care.
If you hear about people experimenting with your materials, how do you feel about that?
The unfortunate or fortunate thing about illegalizing these things is that there is an entire culture of especially young college people who, as soon as a drug is made illegal, they get interested in it. And so this increases the interest and the use by a great many people, instead of what would happen if it were just left alone legally. People would experiment and then probably forget about it and go on to other things. The psychedelics are not for everybody.
And I'm a little bit saddened because the more they make these materials illegal and give them a bad reputation, the longer it's going to be before their potential value as research tools in the clinical laboratory will be realized.
Exactly.
I'm rather saddened by that.
It'll change.
How would you like it to be done? How would you like drugs education to be done? How would you like drugs to be dealt with, ideally?
I think ideally there should be a repeal of the national laws that make them illegal. They make them available through pharmacies, through various legitimate organizations with which the purity and the dosage can be well established, and make them a person that wishes to explore this area, he should be free to find a legal source and explore. There should be no law prohibiting a person, an adult person, from doing what he wishes with his own body. That I feel very strongly about.
And it's the same thing as trying to make hypnosis or deep dreaming illegal. I mean, these are other ways in which we discover what we're made of inside. I mean, you know, spiritually and emotionally. Dreaming is very effective this way, if you can remember your dreams, and hypnosis will open the same doors that psychedelics do. And, you know, sometimes I wonder if governments would they make those processes also illegal? It's a self-exploration.
The prohibition has rarely worked well. In fact, I can't think of a time it has worked well. We had in this country alcohol prohibition. It led to additional crime, and once the prohibition was removed, the crime went. So I believe the idea of prohibition, prohibiting human behavior, is intrinsically a lost cause.
One of the things that you're most famous for is the rediscovery of MDMA. What is your opinion about MDMA, and how do you feel about the way that it's unfolded?
My opinion on MDMA is that it is probably a unique tool, an extremely potentially valuable tool in the use of therapy, in psychotherapy.
Yeah.
It tends, as its popularity and raves establishes, to drop the barriers of communication, not only with you and other people, but you and yourself. And that is, of course, one of the immense values in psychotherapy, in which you have to establish an openness in which you acknowledge to the therapist what your problems are so they can be addressed. And this material tends to dissolve that barrier of communication. And I'm sorry to see that it's been made illegal, and the research in that direction has been grossly hindered. And I wish someday that might change, and it goes back into the hands of therapists that can use it with their patients.
I understand that you've written books, and a lot of your work is now published.
I'm a firm believer of getting all the information out, good and bad, about all drugs, making it available at all to everyone. And that includes the negatives as well as the positives. I believe the suppression of any factual information is wrong. Publishing the literature is a very necessary thing to get all the information that's found out into the medical, clinical, and the chemical literature. So I publish papers quite regularly in peer-reviewed scientific journals. Probably over 200 papers now. And also, Anne and I have written two books, one Pikao and one Tikao, that have brought more of the unpublished information into the public domain to where it will obviously be available.
And in case anybody wants to get hold of them, they are available either from the Transform Press or a lot of bookstores, in fact, most bookstores, I think, at this point.
Great. We're more than happy to plug those excellent books, and we'll also link to Dr. Shulgin's site on our website, thegooddrugsguide.com. Now, just to wind things up, I've got a great quote from you here, which I think neatly sums up your position on drugs and ours too.
I believe that every single thing that is known about a drug, good and bad, should be available to everyone who's considering using that drug.
And I support that, and I also would like to quote something Sasha says very often, and it's absolutely true. There is no casual experiment.
Great. Well, thanks to Alexander and Anne Shulgin there. You can reach Dr. Shulgin online at askdrshulgin.com, and we'll be linking to that from our website too. It's probably time now for our disclaimer.
The Good Drugs Guide does not recommend taking any drugs at all. We honestly cannot say that any of them are without risk, from white sugar to heroin, so please be very careful in your choices. The best choice is probably just to listen to the show and to take none of the following: amphetamines, ayahuasca, booze, caffeine, cocaine, cannabis, DMT, DXM, ephedrine, GHB, heroin, ibogaine, ketamine, cat, kratom, LSD, mescaline, meth, methadone, methylone, mushrooms, nitrous, opium, piperazine, salvia, tobacco, SSRIs, Viagra, Valium, Xanax, and Zubiclone.
Well, that's all we got time for this week. The music you've been hearing in the background was Ulrich Schnaus and Love Moment, because I'm in a soppy mood. You can catch both Piers and I on Midnight Sex Talk on Resonance this Sunday with Tanya Glide. We'll be talking about our favourite two things, drugs and sex. Midnight Sunday at Resonance. In the meantime, if you need drugs help, information or advice, check out our website, thegooddrugsguide.com, thegooddrugsguide.com. It's chock full of the stuff. I'm David McCandless.
I'm Piers Gibbon.
Thanks for listening. We'd like to leave you with this flawless pearl of wisdom from Nancy Reagan.
So open your eyes to life, to see it in the vivid colors that God gave us as a precious gift to his children, to enjoy life to the fullest and to make it count. Say yes to your life, and when it comes to drugs and alcohol, just say no. Thank you.